Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. While it's no longer politically correct to use racial or gender-related remarks that stereotype groups of people, what about negative Appalachian stereotypes? You've heard them before. Appalachians are commonly stereotyped as white, lazy, tobacco-smoking, overall-wearing, poverty-stricken folks with poor dental hygiene, no indoor plumbing, and no shoes. So how does that influence the pursuit of an education? Well, new research shows that it depends on the individual Appalachian mindset.
Growing up in Mingo County was in many ways very good and in many ways different than other areas.
Erica Donovan is originally from a small, unincorporated town just outside of Williamson.
It is a primarily small coal town. It's what most of the men in the area do. And a small college-educated population.
According to the 2012 U.S. Census, about 10% of residents in Mingo had a bachelor's degree or higher. That's a far cry from the state average of 18%, and further still from the nation's average of 28%. But perhaps the most startling statistic is the rate of residents who are high school graduates. In the U.S., about 86%, West Virginia, 83%, Mingo County, about 71%. Although Donovan's parents always encouraged her to go to college and get an education, in the community, higher education was considered a good but kind of mystical idea.
College was almost like a fantasy land. You heard about it, you watched the sports teams play. Once in a while, a guidance counselor would drop the name of a scholarship, but I had no idea what you actually had to do to reach college, or what it would be like once I got there.
Donovan attended West Virginia University as a first-generation college student. Although she didn't feel like her professors thought less of her or anticipated that she would perform more poorly because of her background, she was convinced that they saw her as interesting, and the students would often have a stereotypical reaction to her deep Appalachian twang.
And on our third day, I said the word pencil, but at the time my accent was much thicker, so I'm sure I said pencil. And one of the boys giggled at me, and he asked me if I could say something else. He gave me a list of words to say out loud. And you almost feel like you're a circus act, you know. Can you recite a list of words so I can poke fun at how you sound? I don't think he was doing it to be cruel. I think he just, it was different for him.
On that day, Donovan felt like an outsider in her own home state.
I certainly never thought of myself as an outsider. I chose a West Virginia college. I'm a very proud resident of West Virginia. I was happy to be there. And I never considered myself as an outsider, as a West Virginian at a West Virginia school. But there were a large population of out-of-state students. And I think to them, Southern West Virginians in particular, were interesting because the culture is different, the language is different. But I don't think anyone ever likes to be made to feel like they are the outsider.
And she's not alone. We heard from Trey Lockhart, spring of 2013. Lockhart was stereotyped as a part of the prescription pill epidemic in Appalachia. It was his second semester in college after growing up in McDowell County. He was shocked, to say the least, at someone's reaction when he told them he wanted to pursue a career in the medical field.
I mean, there's something. I had one woman tell me when I had to speak. And they said, well, I hope you're not going to be a pill pusher. So I was like, well, I don't plan on it.
In McDowell County, about 63% of the residents have a high school diploma, while only 6% have a college degree. The remarks didn't sway Lockhart's pride in his home county. Erica Donovan says she tried to take things with a grain of salt.
And just be proud of where you're from. When I first went to college, my accent embarrassed me. I tried everything I could do to get rid of it. And the longer that I was there, the more proud I was to have it. I'm from Mingo County. I'm a proud Mingo County resident. Own where you're from and wear it proudly.
Donovan graduated from WVU and is now teaching in Kanawha County. And Lockhart is still pursuing a pre-med biology degree. But how does stereotyping influence the pursuit of an education? Well, it depends on the individual Appalachian mindset. Director of Retention at Concord University is Sarah Beasley. It's her job to basically keep students enrolled and graduated at the school.
At Concord, a high percentage of our students are also the first in their family to go to college and low income. And a lot of research out there shows that low income and first generation students are less likely, not only less likely to attend college, but less likely to graduate. And they have lower confidence in their abilities to actually attain a degree. So I think it's important that we have the discussion in higher ed in West Virginia.
Beasley recently hosted a forum called Appalachian Stereotypes and the Impact on Student Success. Beasley's interest grew out of her dissertation research in Mingo County. She looked at college access and the success of rural first-generation students. Beasley asked college-bound or current college students to share any positive or negative stereotypes they know about West Virginia or Appalachia.
All I heard were negative, and I think most West Virginians can guess what those negative stereotypes were. Oh, people think we're ignorant, we're hillbillies, rednecks. And it just made me think about if that's what our students hear about our region and our culture and people, what kind of effect might that have on their success academically and their self-confidence to do well in school and college?
Beasley grew up in southern West Virginia and attended public schools. She went on to study psychology at the elite Harvard University. But she herself had to overcome her own self-doubt to succeed.
Thinking, well, I'm just from southern West Virginia. There's no way I'm as smart as these kids from all over the country and all over the world. I went to a poor public high school. How can I compete with these kids from private high schools or rich suburban high schools? And it really got me thinking a lot. And the older I got, I realized, you know, it's not that someone's any less smart or I'm dumber because I didn't have those experiences, but it's just that, you know, I started at a different point. If I worked hard, I could catch up with most of them.
I should also point out that Beasley is not a first-generation college student. In fact, her father, Jerry Beasley, is a former president at Concord University. Her mother, the late Jean Beasley, graduated from Marshall University with a bachelor's in English and Latin and later earned a law degree from WVU. Sarah remembers some stories of her mother's time at Marshall.
She even had some professors tell her, well, you know, with your southern accent, you'll never be a good public speaker. You're not going to pass my speech class with that accent. But she went on to be one of the valedictorians at Marshall. So she, and I think she was able to do that because she realized it was effort and hard work that made a difference.
Effort and hard work. So what about the folks who say they're just not good in math?
I think it's important to remember that they have the same ability as any other student who's making good grades in math. It just takes that hard work and effort, not being afraid to ask for help, and also learning the strategies like study skills, how to take notes to succeed in the subject.
Beasley says what's at play here is something called mindset theory, which basically breaks people into two categories: those who believe intelligence is something that you're born with, and those who believe that you can improve how smart you are. But the good part about that is that it's possible to teach students to go from thinking that they're stuck with the intelligence they have to realizing that intelligence is achievable. Beasley is hoping the forum is just the beginning of the conversation to help students at Concord and across Appalachia begin to believe in themselves. And it might just take another Appalachian stereotype to make that happen. Grit. Another study out of the University of Pennsylvania found a relationship between the amount of grit and level of success. The more grit, the more success. 60 years ago, two West Virginia schools, Dunbar High School and Fairmont Senior High School, met for the first and last time on the football field. Marion County historians say it was the first gridiron meeting in West Virginia of an all-black school and an all-white school. As Sarah Lowther Hensley of West Virginia Public Radio reports, it came amid the tension surrounding the 1954 landmark U.S. Supreme Court ruling on school segregation.
It's been 60 years since the game, but local historian D.D. Men says the event continues to resonate and offer lessons for today. He and a group of others rediscovered the story of the game a few years ago while researching how to handle an uptick in racial tension.
This football game in 1954 seemed to be the answer, where in the midst of a week full of very high tension, where parents were protesting the integration of schools, school outside of Fairmont, that this first football game between a black and a white school was being played, and we were interested as to how that worked out.
The game was played on September 30th, 1954, just a few months after the Supreme Court told schools in America they would have to integrate. The court granted schools time to comply. Dunbar and Fairmont Senior High Schools were to be integrated the following year. The two school principals agreed that although they had never played each other before, they would compete in this final year before the two schools went together. But just days before the game, tensions in the county were running high. The Marion County Board of Education had started the integration process that fall, a move that was met with protests, pickets, boycotts, and threats at one small school. A local judge denounced the actions as rebellion against the government and issued an injunction against protesters. With that as a backdrop, the two teams prepared to meet for the first and last time. Local law enforcement was on high alert and out in force. But Min says the event ran smoothly, and he credits the fact that although they attended different schools, the players all knew each other.
The surprising thing was, and people didn't realize this, that these young men had played against each other in sandlot ball and even lived next to each other. And so there was absolutely no violence and no trouble that evening, and there was only three penalties called.
Min says that familiarity and an ability to enjoy friendly competition were the keys then and are the keys now to easing racial tensions and fostering healthy communities. As America refocuses on these tensions in light of unrest in Ferguson, Missouri, and elsewhere, Min believes a football game played 60 years ago offers lessons and hope. Lesson number one, opportunities to live, work, and play together are key.
And I think a secondary lesson is that we need to utilize sports in a better way. When people talk about this game 60 years ago, they don't talk about really who won or who lost. The score was incidental except to the players, and they still debate as to how they could have won, what could have happened that would have made the game different. But it was a great game. 7-6 was the final score, by the way. But I think we need to fashion sports in a way in which we don't have such a high level of competition, but a lot of cooperation.
But that seems the opposite of where we've headed with sports.
Yeah, it seems to be, and with the high salaries and everything, and the premium placed on children competing at a high level and getting involved in intensive training even as early as preschool, it kind of takes the joy out of just sharing the athleticism on the field or, wherever it may be.
So 7-6, who won?
You'll have to ask them. Fairmont Senior won, but the person from Dunbar who represents Dunbar said they could have won if they'd run the play that he wanted to run.
The Dunbar-Fairmont Senior football game of 1954 is now firmly back in the community's shared memory and commemorated with a special plaque at East West Stadium, where it was played 60 years ago. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Sarah Lowther Hensley in Fairmont.
In Charleston, West Virginia, during segregation, a neighborhood known as the Block once had dozens of thriving businesses and was the heart of the African-American community. But in the 1960s, urban redevelopment moved in, the interstate expanded, and newer buildings replaced historic buildings that were once the lifeblood of the Block. Barbara Hicks Lacey recently shared her story of the heydays, thanks to the West Virginia Center for African American Culture and Arts. Roxy Todd of West Virginia Public Radio reports.
When I was In high school, everything was really segregated.
When she was a kid, Barbara Hicks Lacey's best friend, named Baby Sue, was white, and so they weren't allowed to attend the same school. The block was full of characters, and during segregation, she saw many well-to-do black tourists and musicians who came through her neighborhood.
Particularly when the rhythm and blues people were coming to town and there was going to be a dance.
Lacey worked at her father's restaurant, the Block Cafe. She explained that she got to meet a lot of these people because the restaurants in the block were the only place where non-whites were allowed to eat, and they had to stay at the Ferguson or the Brown Hotel. Here, it was safe for children to roam around the neighborhood together, and that meant Lacey was free to, well, express herself in many ways. She told one story about a bar owned by Mr. Penn. She doesn't think her mother ever found out that often as a little kid, Lacey would stop by Mr. Penn's bar to perform a song or two. She had it in her mind that she was an undiscovered Shirley Temple. Mr. Penn would lift her up onto the bar, and Lacey would sing.
And I'd sing, "Nighttime is the Right Time." Oh, man, that was before quarter.
She earned a quarter for singing at the beer joint. That quarter was usually spent down the street at the Ferguson Theater, where Lacey said she spent almost every afternoon after school watching movies.
That's what we did, all the kids in the neighborhood. We went to the movie every day.
But these movies were basically the same films that were shown at the White Theater. Separated by a few blocks, during segregation, downtown Charleston essentially was split into two sides, roughly along Washington Street. Garnett High School was the local black school, about a block away from Lacey's father's cafe. As Lacey described the people that she remembers, like Flat Tire the barber, Mabel Cook the beautician, and Richard Saunders the usher at the Ferguson Theater, they all seemed like vivid characters out of a great novel. Its pages were written on the side alleys and brick streets off Shrewsbury Street, where Barbara Hicks Lacey grew up. Though the buildings and people she remembers are mostly all gone, the story has not been erased. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Roxy Todd in Charleston.
Ms. Lacey's talk was part of a series called African American Life in Charleston, A Personal Perspective. To see photos of the Ferguson Theater and Hotel, you can visit wvpublic.org. And a new exhibit that honors the African-American history of the Greenbrier Valley in West Virginia are on display this month at the Cooper Gallery in Lewisburg. The exhibit is called Invisible Roots and Legends, a photographic view of African-American history in Greenbrier Valley, West Virginia. The display is a collection of photographs and artifacts from post-Civil War to today. The show also highlights a few individuals who were born and raised in Greenbrier County, left the area, and are making a significant impact in various areas such as the U.S. government, the arts, and more. The exhibit will run through October 4th. Folks in Kentucky at the Louisville Free Public Library are marking the 60th anniversary of a landmark episode in the civil rights movement. It's called Black Freedom, White Allies, and Red Scare, Louisville, 1954. It commemorates a year when white civil rights activists led by Carl and Ann Braden bought a home on behalf of the Wades, an African-American family that had been trying to locate in a Kentucky neighborhood. They were faced with burning crosses and a steady campaign of harassment. The home was eventually blown up with dynamite. The family wasn't home at the time, but the Bradens were accused of staging the whole thing as a communist plot, and Carl served 8 months in prison before the case was thrown out. The exhibit will be on display at the Louisville Free Public Library through the 1st of November. One historian in West Virginia says studying gravestones and its cemeteries is a good way to find out more about a town's history. Liz McCormick of West Virginia Public Radio reports.
Dr. Keith Alexander is a professor and historian at Shepherd University in Shepherdstown, but his teachings go beyond the classroom. Many of Dr. Alexander's courses are focused in historic preservation, and part of that curriculum is going out in the field and actually preserving history, starting with a graveyard.
I think that gravestones are a record and a tangible link to our past that triggers this curiosity among people.
Dr. Alexander gave a public talk hosted by the Historic Shepherdstown Commission about what our gravestones can tell us. He often works with his students preserving three of Shepherdstown's four main cemeteries. These three cemeteries are the Lutheran Graveyard, the Shepherd Burial Ground, where Thomas Shepherd, the founder of Shepherdstown, is allegedly buried, and Elmwood Cemetery, the largest in the town, which incorporates a Methodist and Presbyterian cemetery and a Confederate soldier's lot.
We walk by historic buildings all the time. We use them, we inhabit them. We don't raise that many questions about it. With cemeteries, they're historical. By definition, they're historical, and they are so tangible. They're these tangible reminders of our own mortality. They are open-air museums. They contain incredibly beautiful sculptures. They are parks, nature preserves oftentimes, and they are these accessible historical repositories.
Dr. Alexander says as long as you have permission from the owner of the grounds, it's very easy for anyone in the state to start preserving gravestones and learn more about the history of their area.
You can start very, very simply. A bucket of water and a sponge or a soft bristled brush and a notebook. That's pretty much all you really need to get started. You can do some basic preservation that way, like I said, removing that biological growth, slowing down the process of decay of those stones, and then, above all, recording what is there.
He says the importance of preserving gravestones is to ask more questions.
Every time I turn to one of these stones, okay, I've got the data, but I want to know more. Why did people live such short lives? Why was the infant mortality rate so high? Why were there these bumps in mortality in those certain years, 1855, for example? What were the lives of the people like behind the stones? It's the stories behind the stones. That's what these stones have to tell us.
If we don't work to preserve our past, Dr. Alexander says we'll lose those resources available to us and could possibly never find out those answers. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Liz McCormick in Shepherdstown.
Got that sweet mountain soul down in my bones.
It's time to find out what's in a name, a segment on Inside Appalachia that explores the history and folklore of the names of Appalachian places. This week, we're exploring a small town in Tennessee with help from a librarian in the state.
My name is Beverly Tolman, and I'm the director of the Charles Ralph Holland Memorial Library in Gainesboro, Tennessee, in Jackson County. We are considered the very foothills of the Appalachians. The backwaters of the Cumberland.
The name we're exploring this week? Well, it's a town with a name that isn't really a name at all. Or is it? Find out what's in this Tennessee name after the break. This is Inside Appalachia.
Got that sweet mountain spirit down in my veins. And it flows. No matter where I might roam, these hills and hollers are my home. I got that sweet mountain spirit down in my veins. Some people call me hillbilly. Some people call me mountain man. Call me Appalachia. Appalachia's what I am.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. So what's in the name of nameless Tennessee? Well, according to Beverly Chalman, director of the Jackson County Library, it's a story of a town that just couldn't settle on their name.
According to the story, it goes that the people that were settled there in that community could not decide on a name. And so as the postman would deliver or address the mail, he would write nameless on the, because they had not yet decided. So, and he would deliver it as to the nameless community. And so eventually that's just the name they took on, nameless. It's very rural, not a whole bunch of people, but really nice, and nice folks, as all of Jackson County is really good people. They actually are a very active little community. They have a little community center, and they really, really, like, they do T-shirts about Ask Me About Nameless, and I'm from the Nameless community, and each year they do fundraisers to help support that community. And so, you know, they're a very active little group. I don't think there are a whole lot there, but they are an active, you know, group that wants you to know they're out there.
If you have another story about Nameless Tennessee or know of another place in Appalachia with an interesting sound or mysterious folklore behind it, send us a tweet at @InAppalachia and we just might explore it inside Appalachia. The Appalachian Trail is more than 2,000 miles long, stretching from Georgia to Maine. In 1955, Emma Grandma Gatewood became the first woman to hike the entire Appalachian Trail. She was 67 years old and hiked the entire trail in a pair of kids. You know, those white, traditionally canvas shoes with the small white tag on them? Anyway, here, author Ben Montgomery tells how Grandma Gatewood escaped domestic violence, encountered a group of gangsters from Harlem, and scaled Mount Katahdin, the northernmost part of the Appalachian Trail.
You're listening to This Land Radio. I'm Elliot Rambach. Ben Montgomery is a journalist for the Tampa Bay Times and the author of the book Grandma Gatewood's Walk. Ben grew up hearing stories about Emma Gatewood, who is his mother's great-aunt. He heard that Emma once fought off a bear with an umbrella, and he also heard that she walked the Appalachian Trail when she was 67 years old.
In 1955, she told her family that she was going on a walk, and she left her small hometown of Gallipolis, Ohio, and journeyed to Mount Oglethorpe in Georgia. She told no one what she meant by taking a walk, until she hit about Roanoke, Virginia, and she dropped a postcard in the mail to her children saying, when I said walk, I meant I'm hiking 2,050 miles. She's, you know, born into poverty in southeastern Ohio, got married at the age of 18 to a guy named P.C. Gatewood. She very quickly learned that PC had an insatiable sexual appetite. She bore him 11 kids total and also quite the temper. He abused her to no end. Nobody remembers exactly what set the fight off. Her son Nelson, who was a teenager at the time, about 15 years old, he comes in and finds his father on top of his mother. He's broken her ribs, he's broken her teeth. Her ear is ripped from her face. Nelson sees this and grabs his father, pins his arms against his sides for long enough that Emma could run away. PC went to town, and Emma eventually returned to the house. When PC came back, he was trailed by a constable or a sheriff's deputy or some keeper of the peace. As soon as PC opened the screen door to go inside the house, Emma hurled a 5-pound sack of flour that connected squarely with his face. She first read of the Appalachian Trail in a doctor's office in the early 50s. She had just picked up a copy of a 1949 National Geographic magazine. It was a multi-page color photograph spread of the Appalachian Trail with this very rosy picture of the trail, and said, you know, anybody in decent physical shape could, quote, hayfoot, strawfoot from Georgia to Maine. This turned her on. She had always been a pedestrian. She never knew how to drive a car. So anytime she wanted to go visit a friend. It was nothing to walk 13, 14, 15 miles. She was hung up on the idea of trying out this, what at the time was a very new footpath. She wound up having this hilarious meeting with these gangsters from Harlem on the AT in the Green Mountains of Vermont. She's hiking along and she finds herself in severe rain. She needs a place to stay for the night and she hikes up on this lean-to beside the trail. A lean-to is just a three-sided structure. Inside the lean-to, she finds, as she describes in her diary, eight African-American youths and their two white leaders from a Catholic parish in Harlem. She is going to have to hole up for the night with the kids and the Catholic leaders. She's in the corner, and one of the boys is laying next to her, and he keeps, in his sleep, throwing his arm over her. She'll move it back. He'll throw it again, and she'll move it back, and he'll throw it back over. It turns out she had no idea, but one of the Catholic leaders wrote about this just before his death, and he said that it was 1955 in Harlem, and the gangs were fighting over every square inch of concrete. The summer was hot. It was a lot of bloodshed, maybe the most violent place in America at the time. The leader of the church said, we've got to do something about this. And so this young priest got the assignment, like, I want you to identify top four honchos of each of these two rival gangs and take them on an all-expense-paid trip to the Green Mountains of Vermont so that y'all can broker peace. And those are the people that Emma wound up bunking with, the eight toughest gangsters in Harlem. When she set off, she didn't tell anybody. She thought her kids might try to stop her. She thought somebody might try to harm her on the trail. Around Roanoke, Virginia, the newspaper caught up with her. Basically, a couple of guys who maintained the trail heard that she was hiking, and they informed the paper, and the paper shows up, and they do a story. From there on, just about every town that she walked through, there was a newspaper story, to the point where the United Press and the Associated Press were tracking her movements for pretty much the entirety of the last half of the trail, maybe on a weekly basis until she got to the end, until she hit Maine. And then it was like a daily update that was running in pretty much every newspaper in the United States. She started to get annoyed by reporters. She was like, I'm done with photographs. And I think she was self-conscious in that she wasn't looking all that great at the end of a 2,000-mile walk. This one photographer pops out of the bushes or whatever and starts taking her picture, and she was having none of it. She whacked him. She apologized immediately after she did it. She said, I'm sorry. I don't know what's going on. And somebody brought her a lawn chair and a glass of milk and a hamburger, and she took a break and felt better about it. I think she was sort of reaching her wit's end, you know, and certainly losing her patience with the press. 146 days after she started, she climbed Mount Katahdin in Maine and sang the first verse of America the Beautiful and said, I did it. There's something about Mount Katahdin in Maine. I've heard people say it's the first spot in the United States where the sun hits when it rises in the east. It's barren on top of that mountain, no trees. And this incredibly strong wind that blows all the time. Trying to reach the crest of Mount Katahdin is like a sort of solitary experience. It's almost like we're not supposed to be here. I think she was pretty overcome by like the significance of it and the aloneness of it.
We
This year, on August 31st, the four members of the Callan family completed the entire length of the trail in exactly 5 months. Their family included 1 8-year-old and 1 9-year-old child. While they were still en route to Maine, NPR's Rachel Martin spoke with the four members of the Callan family.
The Callan family, Dave, Emily, Maddie, Nathan, and Orion the dog, think they can beat the 1 in 4 odds. Did I mention Nathan is 9 and Maddie is only 8? We caught up with the family in Harper's Ferry, West Virginia, where they were celebrating Maddie's birthday. Dave Callan told us what inspired them to take this bold trip in the first place.
Emily and I have actually walked the Appalachian Trail from Maine to Georgia before, back in 2002. And when we were on that trip, we met another family, a family of 4 from Idaho that did the whole thing that year. And they were traveling with a 6 and an 8-year-old. And we found them to be a very inspiring family and decided that if we ever had kids and had a family together, we wanted to do something like that with our kids. So here we are 12 years later, and we're walking north. We live in Maine now, so we're homeward bound.
Is your wife Emily standing right there?
She is, yes. Let me pass you over.
Hi, Emily. This is quite a remarkable thing that your family is doing. What was the reaction from your kids when you told them that you were going to hike from Georgia to Maine?
There was definitely some apprehension at first. They weren't quite sure whether they would be able to do it or not, but there was never any unwillingness to try.
And how are you handling schooling the kids? Because they've obviously been pulled out of school. Are you homeschooling on the trail? Did you just take them out for a year?
I basically met with each of the teachers to talk about what they would be missing. The principal just thought it was a great idea, and she didn't foresee there being any issues. And Nathan's teacher had said that they were going to work on changing fractions to decimals and decimals to fractions. So as we go along, we talk about how many more miles we have to go to a certain spot, and Nathan will change the decimals to fractions, and we just keep plenty of learning going as we're walking.
Have you had any kind of meltdown moments?
One that I can think of, we were going through the Smokies, and it was a mixture of snow and hail, and we hiked about 12 miles in that. And since we're hiking in kind of tennis shoes, not boots, because for the most part, we don't have any snow on the ground, everyone's feet were wet and very cold. I think it got down to 7 degrees that night, and in the morning, everybody's shoes and socks were frozen solid, and there was a little meltdown when we tried to get the kids to put their feet into those socks and shoes. So Dave saved the day by putting everyone's shoes and socks inside his shirt, inside his sleeping bag with him for about an hour until they warmed up a little bit.
Well, Emily, do you mind handing the phone to Nathan or Maddie?
Okay, we'll pass it over to Maddie. Here we go.
Hi, Maddie. First of all, happy birthday.
Thanks.
So, Maddie, what is the trip like for you? Has it been fun most of the time?
Yeah, it's been fun a lot of the time.
Have you seen any wild animals?
Yeah, we saw a porcupine. We've seen 2 bears. They were both in the Shenandoahs, and one just climbed up the tree and sat there, and then it basically fell to the ground. It was just taking its hands off and bringing them back on, and just so it shot down the tree.
Oh my gosh.
It was cool.
Yeah, it sounds really cool. Can I talk to your dad again, Maddie?
Sure.
Thank you.
Hi, Rachel.
Does Nathan want to talk?
I'm sure that you could get him to talk a little bit.
Sure, let's put him on the line.
Okay.
Hello.
Hi, Nathan. How's it going?
Good.
Nathan, how are your legs doing and your feet? Do you get a lot of blisters on this trip?
No, I got 1 blister because my socks turned into pretty much sandpaper.
Ooh.
But that's the only blister any of us have gotten all trip.
Oh, that's pretty good.
At the beginning, my feet were really sore and hurting, but we got some new insoles, and now they're feeling fine.
Yeah. Well, thanks for talking to me, Nathan.
You're welcome.
Can you hand the phone back to your dad?
Okay, here he
Thank
is.
Thank you.
Hi, Rachel.
Can you describe a typical day? Is there such a thing? Do you try to develop a sort of routine?
Our routine is that each day we wake up, we eat, and we walk north. But beyond that structure, every day is completely different. We meet new people, we see new things. Some days we're up on ridges looking out for miles. Other days we're walking in a tunnel of green trees. Other days we're following a stream or a brook or climbing through rocks or into caves. So it's really exceptionally varied.
You've definitely raised the bar for the family vacation, though, right? I mean, can you just take your kids to Disneyland next year? Will they be satisfied with that?
I don't know. I think certainly the parents wouldn't be satisfied with that. But we hope that, you know, this will be one of many journeys, and it's hard to predict now what those might look like. But in some ways we've raised the bar, and in other ways it's not just a vacation, but more of kind of a shared growth as a family.
Well, good luck with everything. It is quite an adventure. The Callan family, Dave, Emily, Nathan, and Maddie, thanks so much for sharing your story with us.
Bye. Thank you.
That was Rachel Martin of NPR News speaking with the four members of the Callan family back in June. The Callans completed their hike along the Appalachian Trail on August 31st. While hundreds of Appalachian Trail miles straddle the Virginia-West Virginia borders, only 4 miles of the trail actually reside in West Virginia, which I should also point out is the only state that's 100% Appalachian. So in 2013, Bart Houck and Joanna Swanson set out to complete the first thru-hike of the Great Eastern Trail. It's based on the AT, but its path would traverse more than 110 miles inside West Virginia's borders and run from Alabama through Georgia, Tennessee, Kentucky, Virginia, Maryland, Pennsylvania, and New York. The idea is to give hikers an alternative to the often crowded AT. The fairly new trail system is specifically routed through the coalfields with intentions to spark economic growth. Some folks, especially this hiking team, believes that the new trail could have an impact on the region. I caught up with Southern West Virginia native Bart Houck as he prepared for the first through hike and learned that completing this hike was just the beginning.
But this is something that I wrote to inspire me to get down the trail.
Bart Houck, or Hillbilly Bart as he prefers, grew up in Mullins in Wyoming County. Along with Vista volunteer Joanna Swanson, Houck is preparing to attempt the first thru-hike of the Great Eastern Trail.
It wasn't a knee-jerk reaction. Obviously, the first time that I was asked by Joanna Swanson to go on this hike, I declined.
Houck is hoping to raise awareness about the Great Eastern Trail and the potential impacts it would have on southern West Virginia.
New trail system like this just doesn't pop up every year, and to actually try to be one of the first to hike this trail and to showcase it and to bring it into light is actually a very humbling experience, and I hope that I'm able to go through with it.
The Appalachian Trail was conceived in the 1920s and completed by 1937. Earl Schaefer, a Pennsylvania veteran, is the first person to hike the entire length of the trail. In 1948, Schaefer walked from Georgia to Maine. Reporting to the Appalachian Trail Conservancy, he made the trip in less than 5 months. Houck is preparing for his attempt at the first thru-hike of the Great Eastern Trail by exploring Schaefer's book, Walking with Spring.
The things I'd like to know from this book are the times that he was deflated. I mean, anytime you walk on a trail, you can always go on a sunny day and come back home. But when you're out there, you're going to have really cold, rainy days. You're going to have foot problems. You're going to have some kinds of medical problems. You know, you can catch colds. You know, it's 4.5, 5 month hike. These things are going to come up. How he prepared for it, how he dealt with it. I'd like to get into his mind and figure out how he dealt with his struggles, because it's going to be, I feel, more of a mental challenge than it is a physical one.
Houck also spends time hiking in his favorite state park, Twin Falls, which will host a portion of the Great Eastern Trail. The trail's about 70% complete. This means some of Houck's hike will have to be along highways.
Let the story know that I've got a really mean razor tooth Corona saw in one hand and a pair of bypass pruners in the other. That is the physical part of it.
That's Tuganu Hiking Club President Tim McGraw. The club is responsible for establishing the West Virginia Trail system. He shows the tools he uses to bushwhack or clear the trail during a short hike along a trail at Twin Falls State Park.
If you could imagine this clear, beautiful trail that we're on now in Twin Falls State Park, the rest of most of the 95% or more of a trail in southern West Virginia is briars and sticks and fallen trees, and it's a nightmare jungle to pass through. That's what we have to deal with if we finally ever get landowner permission. We're going to have to go out there and start cutting and hacking and snipping and digging and building bridges.
Hikers along this trail stroll by two waterfalls. Hauk says it's sites like these that he hopes to showcase to the world by bringing attention to the Great Eastern Trail. The trail is mapped to go through small towns like Pineville, Hinton, and Mullins, once bustling with railroad and coal activity, and like so many towns, now desperately in need of an economic boost. Town manager of Parisburg, Virginia, says the AT has become an important part of the economy there, and Hauk hopes to do the same for his hometown and all of the coal fields.
A lot of people may not understand that a through hike is not actually, you're not out there with a horse and covered wagon for 4.5 months. You actually have to come in and resupply. So a lot of these towns benefit from the influx of these hikers having to come in off the trail. It also is going to be an economic boost for this area that needs a boost other than coal. I'm not against coal. Actually, I have a lot of friends that are in the coal industry, but this is a way to showcase southern West Virginia in a different light.
Hauk says he'll only earn the name Hillbilly Bart after he completes his through hike. Hauk and Swanson completed the hike in June of 2013. The project remains far under the radar, with little attention from lawmakers and even folks in the region. Without more interest, the hike will remain routed with lots of roadwalks, especially in West Virginia, where the Great Eastern Trail Association is facing its biggest challenge. You see, much of the land is owned by private businesses such as timbering, coal, and railroad companies like Pocahontas Land. The company won't allow access for hikers until an entity can provide liability insurance. So far, that hasn't happened. Still, Bart Hauk, or Hillbilly Bart, says he's not giving up on his hopes to gain permission for hikers to cross portions of private land. And along the Allegheny hiking trail in West Virginia, volunteers are busy counting the peak of the fall migration for broad-winged hawks. Volunteers have counted about 2,150 raptors in the last week. Most of these have been broad-winged hawks, but at least 25 bald eagles were also spotted. Volunteers say that in the last few years, more bald eagles and golden eagles are making their home in southern West Virginia. This time last year, Roxy Todd visited the observatory to talk with volunteers who were helping count the hawks and eagles.
We're at the crest of Peters Mountain. We're at 3,812 feet, and from this vantage point you can see probably 60 miles and almost 360 degree circle.
That's Brian Hurt, one of the volunteers at the Hanging Rock Observatory, located in the southeastern corner of West Virginia in Monroe County. Many seasoned naturalists like Brian say the views atop Peters Mountain make Hanging Rock one of the best places in the country to watch eagles, falcons, and hawks.
It's just one of the best places to personally, I think, to see them on the East Coast. I've traveled to quite a few hawk sites, and the thing about Hanging Rock is they're up close because you're at this altitude, and a lot of times the raptors are actually below you and at eye level a lot of times. Other places you go to, you're looking straight up a lot.
Coming towards us from the north, a hawk seems to be tracing an unseen spiral in the sky. Gliding with outstretched wings, she navigates the columns of warm air which rise from the sloping peaks of Peters Mountain. She gains altitude, gently reaching our eye level. Then above our heads, she begins to soar. The movement, called kettling, will sometimes propel raptors to glide up to 200 miles without flapping their wings even once. For those of us watching from the observatory deck, the steep and slanted ridge below us reveals an incredible view of rolling farmland. We can see as far west as the Winter Place Ski Resort, about 70 miles in Raleigh County, West Virginia. And we can see east as far as the Blue Ridge Mountains in Virginia. We don't have wings, but every now and then a gust of wind lifts our hair, and it sure feels weightless, just for a brief moment.
Group up there, I counted 9 in this a minute ago. There's 2 more.
3 more.
Yeah. 4, 5, 6, 7. I got 7 more coming through.
Jim Phillips is the official counter at Hanging Rock, submitting data every year to the Hawk Migration Association of North America. The records reveal there hasn't been a dramatic increase in hawk sightings in West Virginia, but there have been some huge increases in the number of eagles. Jim also works at Pipestone State Park, and he participates in other eagle surveys throughout southern West Virginia. He says that bald and golden eagles are not only migrating through West Virginia, many more eagles are coming to live in West Virginia year-round in areas near Hanging Rock.
The numbers are coming up, and we're getting good numbers on the golden eagles. The wildlife biologists have actually been doing studies in the Appalachians here, this part of West Virginia to the north of us, and in what borders in Virginia, and they're finding that the greatest population of golden eagles in the east occur in this area.
But it's a fragile balance that the volunteers at Hanging Rock don't take for granted. Rodney Davis, a retired heavy equipment operator, is one of the most active volunteer counters at Hanging Rock.
We used to never get peregrine falcons, and we'll probably have a dozen migrant peregrines now every year.
Rodney has also volunteered with Ron and Wendy Peroni, who are helping to bring peregrine falcons back into West Virginia, releasing them into the New River Gorge area.
That was Roxy Todd at the Hanging Rock Raptor Observatory in Monroe County. In October, other species of raptors like falcons, eagles, and owls will migrate through West Virginia. To see photos from Hanging Rock and to find directions to the observatory tower, you can visit wvpublic.org. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky, This Land Press of Tulsa, Oklahoma, NPR, Kentucky Public Radio, and West Virginia Public Radio. Our opening theme music is by Michael Lipton. Our closing theme music is by Al Petaway and Amy White from their CD, Land of the Sky, from Maggie's Music, with music contributions from Alan Cathead Johnston of McDowell County, West Virginia. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org, find us on Twitter @InAppalachia or @WVJessicaYLilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia, in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.